Hey, everybody. Welcome into the Late Night Gamecock Show. I'm your host, Matt Anderson, and joining me, as always, is Rob Williams of Four Quarter Friday, thebigspur.com. We are excited to be here, man. Rob, you and I feel like we've just been talking so much about Gamecock athletics, and you would think it'd be a downtime.
Yeah, you would think so. You would think so, but there's so much to talk about in general. As we, it's funny. We came on here. We didn't talk about this. There's no plan. We both have Williams Bryce behind us, and we both kind of rotate the background, right? So, and ironically, on the docket tonight, I think football is more towards the bottom of the list. We've got some baseball to talk. We've got some basketball to talk, but there's always football to talk about. To your point, you would think this would be a downtime. It is not. And happy Memorial Day weekend to you, Mr. Late Night Gamecock.
Man, I appreciate it. Happy Memorial Day weekend to you as well. I know we missed each other on the show on Friday.
We're like ships passing in the night on Friday.
You know what? Like, you know, we were just on our way to Sunday night. That's how it works. We're both trying to get to our destination. But we are here again, Rob Williams, Matt Anderson. We're excited to get this show cracking. And like Rob mentioned, we're going to mix some baseball in here, some basketball, and some football. I mean, Rob, we're going to talk about it. But I think, Rob, how old are you? I've never even asked you that.
I'm 32.
Okay, so I'm 37. I don't think that I've ever seen baseball at such a low point in my entire life.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's very strange. It's very strange. It's eerie. But, you know, Matt, I think at this point we, as baseball fans and as South Carolina fans, I'll speak to the fan base at large, having seen what this program can be over the course of decades and over the course of our lives, and even before we were born, Matt, this is the point when I think hope starts to creep back in, because now you're starting to look forward to maybe what can be the next thing. I think a lot of people want to be optimistic, and South Carolina athletics, especially on the men's side, is not given reason to be very optimistic in a lot of areas. But if anything, a fresh new start, hiring a new coach, kind of a clean slate with baseball, can give some people the opportunity to lean into that, into hope.
Yeah, like, and we're going to talk about that here in a little bit, why the Gamecocks could have some hope, should have some hope. But we're also very excited. We're going to have Jamie Shaw of Rivals and Own Three. We're going to talk some basketball portal tonight, some Gamecock basketball in general, you know, where the program stands, recruiting. We're just so fortunate to have Jamie on the show, so we're gonna use him and abuse him for the 20 minutes he is here with us tonight. And then football, I don't know how many of these articles you've caught, Rob, but I've been doing a deep dive into Kendall Briles, and we're going to talk about what that potentially means for the Gamecocks in year one, what it means for Lenore Sellers, and what it means for Gamecock fans who just haven't had a whole lot of hope, to Rob's point, in any men's sport. And maybe South Carolina's on the come up, Rob, but let's go ahead and get it kicked off with baseball. Rob, trivia question for you.
Oh, my.
All right. So coming into this particular college baseball season, so disregard all of the results from this year because they weren't pretty. Where do you think the Gamecock baseball program ranks all time in wins coming into the season in college baseball?
Well, I'll be lying if I said that I was completely clueless on this, because A, I had to look this up at the beginning of the season. So I know that it's top 20. Okay. We'll just say that. You want to give us the actual number here?
Yeah. So it is top 20. The Gamecocks are 18th all time in total wins, a little bit higher than that in win percentage. The Gamecocks, I think this was their 134th season of baseball. So this is a proud program, Rob. And I think that, you know, when you look at two national championships, four national runners up, all the Omaha trips before you and I were born, the Omaha trips since.
Yep.
I think that Gamecock fans just, it's not a successful season if you don't end in Omaha. And lately, you haven't even gone to a Super.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And, you know, I got into a debate during the preseason with some ignoramus on X, which tends to be the periphery out there, that about whether or not South Carolina was a blue blood in baseball. And I think that the stats that you bring up and kind of the history not just in terms of all-time wins, but winning percentage. And then really what they've done in the postseason, Matt, the ability to show up time and time again puts them into that blue blood conversation, to that blue blood territory for me. So when you talk about a proud tradition, when you talk about a proud history, it creates a foundation for a fan base that does have those expectations. This is not the history, and Will Crow said it on the morning show on Friday with Jamie Bradford and myself and Smitty. This is not, with all due respect to football and to basketball, the history that's here sets up differently for Gamecock baseball. And now the women's basketball team has had a lot of success as of late, but if you stretch it for decades, baseball's the only program out of the major sports that can say that they've had this postseason success. So, yes, this is not a blip on the radar. It's not a high watermark where even, dare I say, with the football team, the football program, most fans hang on to the Spurrier years, but the Spurrier years are more so kind of a blip in the overall history of the program. There's no blips with the baseball program. There's been consistency of getting deep into the postseason, and then we saw those national championships, obviously culminating the success of the program there in the Ray Tanner era. So I think that when you look at what has happened the past 2 years and how that moves forward, it is perfectly reasonable for the fan base, the administration, the media around this program to have an expectation that, you're right, it's not successful unless you see Omaha. And you're going to have years when you don't. That's realistic. But you need to be in the postseason, and you need to be challenging to go to Omaha. And you do need to see Super Regionals, I think, 4 out of 5 years, in my opinion.
You know, Rob, it's kind of crazy because you look at it, and there are only a couple, 1, 2, 3, 4. There's only 5 teams that are ahead of the Gamecocks and wins all time that are in the SEC.
Right.
And Texas and Texas A&M, you know, they're recent additions to the SEC. Since South Carolina came in 92, A&M came after that. Texas obviously came recently. Then you got Mississippi State, LSU, Alabama. Of those teams, LSU, yeah, they have 8 national titles, 2 since the Gamecocks won their last. Texas has 6 national titles. They haven't won one in quite a while. I think it goes back to 2002, 2005 maybe. Mississippi State has 1 national title. And A&M and Alabama have actually never won a national title. So despite being ranked, you know, in that top 18 all time,
right,
those teams haven't done it like South Carolina has. 13 seasons since Carolina's last title, my friend. And I think one of the bigger problems is that the SEC has won 8 of them. So you're seeing all these teams that you feel you should compete with, you know, year in and year out. And the Gamecocks just aren't doing it. They haven't made to Omaha since 2012. They've only made the Super Regionals 3 times since 2012, Rob. Like, when I found that statistic, it blew my mind.
Yeah.
Does it feel like that?
No, I don't think that it does. I don't think that it does for us. But I said this on Friday, and I'll say it again here. For the next generation, Matt, that's not even the next generation behind us, because that would be the Gen Z kids that are in school now, but the Gen Alpha kids, or the back end of Gen Z, that are the recruits that these coaches have to go after and get, are 15, 16, 17 years old. And to your point, 13 years have passed. So there's a big stretch in there that these young kids don't even understand the history of this program, because it has kind of begun to wander off from postseason success. So kind of reestablishing itself with this generation of recruits, I think, is a big deal, which is why you need somebody who's going to pull in the alums who have had major success, who can come in and talk about it. It's why you need somebody who is relevant in the game today and is making some noise in the postseason. If it is a guy like Kevin Schnall, obviously, having played in the College World Series final last year with Coastal against LSU, that puts him right in the thick of the conversation with your high school sophomores, juniors, seniors, who you need to go out and get, especially the ones that are closer regionally to the University of South Carolina. They're going to be familiar with a coach like Kevin Schnall, who's at Coastal Carolina. You would have a similar effect with I saw in the chat box somebody mentioned Ramsey at Georgia Tech with whatever they do this year and regionally being kind of close to South Carolina, that puts that on the radar as well. You know, it does not feel for me or for you like it's been that long or like the drought has been as bad as it has been. But if you look down at somebody's life, Matt, who that's half of the length of ours, the drought feels a lot longer.
It really does, man. You look at it, people forget that Chad Holbrook averaged 40 wins a year at South Carolina. And then, you know, even Mark Kingston, you take out that COVID year, he averaged 34 wins. And that got Mark Kingston fired, Rob. And now you look at the last two seasons, they've won 40 games combined. So just 40 games combined. That's absolutely crazy. I mean, the key is win more games, right? I mean, the Gamecocks are 7-7 in midweeks this past season. So, and look, they played North Carolina one of those games, but in the midweeks, they weren't winning. And then, right. You know, look at the SEC, 7-23 this past season, 6-24 the year before. But I mean, Gamecock fans might actually kill for a 13-17, a 16-13, a 16-14, like Mark Kingston did. But at the same time, that got him fired.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I think that the midweeks is what really stands out to me, Matt. And, you know, Ray Tanner would always say that, you know, you win your midweeks, you win your series at home, and you don't get swept on the road. And that leads to your 40-win seasons. And so if we can see the Gamecocks kind of getting back to that type of consistency where that becomes the expectation, that has not been the expectation, and it's continued to slide downward. The bar has continued to lower and lower. And that all starts at the top, and that's why this coaching hire is so paramount, because you got to get somebody in that's going to set the bar back at the expectation of this proud and storied tradition that surrounds the program.
I'm right there with you. I mean, and my question, and we'll tie it up here, you know, is South Carolina in a position to win 40 games next year? Are they in a position to go 500 in the SEC? I don't know, man. They got a lot of work to do. That's why, you know, you mentioned it, you know, to your point, getting that right coach in here, whether it's, you know, Kevin Schnall, who's getting a lot of heat right now, or it's somebody else. They got to figure it out, because with NIL and the transfer portal, it's probably 50-50 at best that you can get this right in year one. Is this a longer rebuild, and will the Gamecock fans have patience? Because right now, that's my question to you, Rob. Will they have patience?
I think that you get a shot in the arm when you hire a new coach, and it brings a little bit of momentum. So there will be some patience to start off with. I think had Jeremiah Donati chosen to hire Monty Lee, there would have been less patience from the fan base, given that it was a consistent move to roll over. Yeah. However, now that it's clear that he's going to go outside, and so you're going to get more of a clean slate. Everybody from on the field was relieved of their duties. So now you're going to get a completely new staff. I think that infuses a little bit of excitement around the program, that fans will give it a chance. Now, you know, JB has said time and time again on the morning show, if it's Kevin Schnall, can he get it going a little quicker? Perhaps. If it's a guy like Dan Fitzgerald from Kansas, it may be a situation where it takes some time to build because of the lack of familiarity with region and the way that he builds a program, how that's going to have to move. And I do think in that case, Matt, that you probably lose somebody, some fans in the outset. But at the end of the day, does the fan base matter? Absolutely. Does the fan base make decisions, or should the fan base make decisions about job security? No. So as long as the administration understands what the plan is to build the program back to where it needs to be, even if fans lose patience, they'll come right back as soon as this team is winning again.
Yeah. So, look, we know JB is going to have you covered on the morning show throughout this coaching search. And when we find out who that coach is going to be, Rob and I will break it down, and we'll break it down for the next 365 days once we figure out who it is. But we got to move on, because we do have Jamie Shaw from Rivals and On Three here. So I want to go ahead and get Jamie in here and talk some hoops. So, Jamie, man, good to see you.
Matt, good to see you too. Rob, how you doing?
Doing well. Good to have you in here. And as two former basketball players, we're happy to lace them up and talk about basketball for a few minutes.
Oh, awesome. Let's go.
So Jamie, real quick. So Rob and I are new to On3 and Rivals, but you know, the name Jamie Shaw, everybody knows that. But for those who are new to our show and haven't heard from you, just give a little bit of your background so folks can get to know you a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So I am the senior national recruiting analyst at On3, now Rivals. What that entails, I guess, is a whole lot of the recruiting intel when it comes to telling the story of the player's recruitment from soup to nuts. Also includes the rankings aspect on the Rivals network as well. So that's kind of where I'm at within the industry.
So we're very thankful to have you. We're going to make the most of your time here. I know that you analyze the portal pretty closely as well as do Rob and I. So let's just jump right in and let's talk some Gamecock additions. And we know they're not done. They still have five more spots on the roster that they'll probably fill out some way or another. But let's go ahead and start with Corey Mincy, probably the first guy to hop in the boat here.
Yeah, no, they got him done pretty quick. Obviously, came from Presbyterian to George Mason. Had a great year at George Mason this past year. George Mason was at the top of the A-10 for the majority of the year, kind of tailed down the end there. Leading scorer from the team. Somebody who comes in that can knock down knock down shots, space the floor a little bit, ball in hand type of initiation type stuff as a secondary type guy. But the shooting aspect is something that you're going to see throughout this entire roster that he brought in, and Mincy certainly brings in shooting at volume with consistency.
Jamie, I'll follow up really quickly there before we jump into the rest of it. I talked to Corey as soon as he committed, and one of the statements that he made to me was that he was going to kind of be the facilitator, and that was what has been presented to him as a guy that's going to kind of come in and run the offense. That does present a little bit of a shift, as you noted, from what we've seen from him in the past, as he's kind of been a score first, pull up shooter, spot up type guy. Can he create in an SEC level based on what you've seen and be able to get the offense moving, even if it's not for his individual shot?
Well, I think what you're going to see from Lamont Paris, what he's tried to do over these last few years, it seems as well, is have multiple initiators on the floor at one time. Even if you go back a couple years ago, the season, they were really good with Talon Cooper, Michi Johnson as well. BJ Mack had some initiation type stuff as well. What they would do was somebody would bring it across half court, get it to somebody else who would then initiate the offense, whether that be Michi, who was the paint touch guy, or BJ kind of at the high post stuff, run some offense through him as well. So I think what you're going to find, not only with shooting with this team, is to have multiple guys on the floor who can have ball in hand decision making as well. And, I the skill aspect was something that felt like Lamont was really pressing for in this cycle. I think Corey falls into that. Corey is somebody who not only can knock down the shot, finish a play, but he's also somebody who can get others involved and kind of move the ball into advantageous situations.
Yeah, see, and that's what I've always preached this, Jamie. It's the biggest issue with Lamont Paris Gamecock teams has been when you didn't have a Talon Cooper to get the ball across half court. That's one of the bigger issues. So as long as they can get the ball across half court, and we've seen Michi Johnson have success there. So we'll see what Corey can do. Shane Blakeney's an interesting guy to me, Jamie, because when I look at him, man, I kind of see a 3-and-D type kid. I don't know if he has the point guard skills, and obviously the 3-point shot has come a long way from where he started. He's bulked up, but what do you see as his role for the Gamecocks this upcoming season?
Well, he's kind of always been somebody, even growing up in Rock Hill, that you always saw the top end aspect of what he could be. And you saw these last couple years at Drexel, him continue to step toward his ceiling. What he is, he's a wing. He's a scoring guard. He's got a little bit of stuff on ball. He can do a little bit of the initiation stuff, but that's not his primary factor. He can guard multiple spots on the opposite end of the floor, and he can create offense, whether that be spot shooting, whether that be two dribble pull-ups, whether that be getting to the basket and transition and all that. He's another guy that you can put on the floor who offensively creates advantages. While also, there's a little versatility that he brings there with the length that he has and all that defensively, guarding across multiple spots.
Yeah, I think that is hitting the nail on the head. The one guy that I'm gonna skip in order here, because this is somebody, let's kind of stay on the wing. It's Davion Hanna. Mm-hmm. And he's a kid that you probably saw extensively in the grassroots level. You know, he had a little bit of time at Alabama this year before going down with an injury. For me, he kind of reminds me of a Sendarius Thornwell type body and ability. Downhill, not really gonna beat you with a 3-point shot. And honestly, his 3-point shot looks really wonky to me. I've never seen the Nike check spin the way it does off his hands. But as far as what he can bring to South Carolina next year, does he have the ability to be a double-digit scorer and somebody that can really set the tone?
I think that he's in position to have a lot of success. The thing that he is, the thing that looks like to me, a couple years ago when you had Talon Cooper, who was kind of the leader of that team, they had Meechie Johnson beside him, and Meechie Johnson had some huge games. What Meechie brought to that team was his ability to consistently create pick touches. Davion Hanna kind of falls into that similar situation as somebody who can have ball in hand, consistently create paint touches. With the paint touch, collapses the defense, gets the scramble defense going, whether he finishes at the rim, a floater, pull-up jump shot, or he moves the ball to get the open look. I think Davion's ability to create a paint touch, to collapse the defense, is something that's going to be unique with the makeup of this roster. That's something that he did in high school, dating back even to the team hero on the EYBL circuit. He always was ball in hand. He was always somebody who was able to get downhill and create paint touches. I think that's something here kind of in that Meechie role. Now, obviously, we also saw Meechie take the 30-foot, hoist the 30-foot jumpers and step backs and stuff like that. That's not necessarily Hannah's game. But getting downhill toward the basket, playing more of an efficient game than Meechie did, I think Hannah has an opportunity kind of in that similar role to really take a step forward and tap into that prospect that was a top, that was a universal top 50 prospect coming out of high school. Didn't necessarily find the stuff last year. I mean, LeBaron Filon, first-round draft pick, Aiden Holloway, 18 a game and all that stuff. The minutes might not necessarily have been there. Kind of similar to what Meechie Johnson did a couple years ago to Ohio State. Couldn't really quite find his footing there. Comes to South Carolina, gets in that system, and really just kind of takes a step forward. I think that could be possibly with Davion Hanna. His ability, as I said, consistently put pressure on the paint, consistently collapse the defense, is kind of unique within the makeup of this roster. And I'm kind of actually really eager to see what he looks like and how that looks on this team.
Yeah, I think that there's multiple guards that were brought in or just it really if you look along the perimeter. But the one of the missing pieces for this team has been those versatile big guys. Who's the most important in your opinion? Who's the most important player that Lamont Paris has brought in so far, and why is it Alexis Bilowski from Wisconsin?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you said his name because I was going to butcher it. So, I think the step that he takes is going to be massive. I think that we were able to see flashes of it last year at Wisconsin. Obviously, the ability, the skill, the ability to kind of stretch the floor a little bit, make decisions with the ball in his hands. I think if you kind of move him into this role, he adds another piece to the spacing and the ball in hand playmaking that Lamont Paris was looking for this team. Obviously 4 points, four rebounds doesn't necessarily jump off the page, but he was a coveted commodity. When they got him, he had multiple other visits set up and all that. Other Power Five schools wanted him and they were doing him. And South Carolina had to make a mark to get him to go on to no more visits and all that, brought him in as a central focus as to what they're going to do. They needed to get a big on the board. They had struck out on a couple ones previously. And I think that he brings a factor that they're looking for, again, able to have five guys who can draw spacing but also make a play with the ball in their hands.
I love that, because another guy that can provide spacing for him is Camden Heidi from Texas. I mean, that's the kind of guy, when he's in the gym, he can make it. And he's going to shoot probably 40, 45, even 50% from three. And when you have what you've talked about so far, Jamie, the ability to get those paint touches and get that space, I mean, for me, I wouldn't be upset if Heidi shot 8, 9, 10 threes a game. That's basically why he's brought in, is to be a shooter. Like, your thoughts on Heidi?
Yeah, and I think Heidi, too, brings another thing that you're looking at with Alexis brought in, with Dave. They're coming from winning programs as well. So, you know, Alexis started however many games it was at a winning program with what Wisconsin did last year, making it to the NCAA tournament. Obviously, Davion Hanna played at Alabama, winning. Cam Heidi has played a national championship game, got minutes in a national championship game. He also, you know, also the last 2 years that he's played, also got to an NCAA tournament as well. Last year, starting 20-something games, whatever, made that huge shot for Texas. Winning culture, winning attitude and all that, aside from the obvious just knockdown shooting aspect. Obviously, when you get somebody who collapses the paint, when you get the ball, when you get paint touches, you want to be able to spread it out to somebody who can knock down shots and all that. Cam Heidi, again, is somebody who not only can knock down shots, he has knocked down shots. Not only has he knocked down shots, he's knocked it down on the biggest of stages possible. So he's somebody who's been there. He's somebody who's been in the situation, but he's also somebody who brings a set valued skill. They talk about it as buzz terminology a lot in the league, but 3 and D. kind of what he brings. There's a physicality. Now, you don't want him on an island guarding one-on-one, but there's a physicality that he brings and understanding of leverage and angles and all that as well, but also the spacing, the floor spacing that he brings, which is something, again, I keep getting back to it, but that's something that Lamont really targeted this year in the portal, what was spacing, as well as guys who can make decisions with the ball in their hands. And I think Cam Heidi plays right into that as somebody that you have to stay attached to, that if you drop off of, then, you know, he's within range.
Jamie, you mentioned that it's valuable that Cam Heidi and others come from winning programs. How much is that valued in the portal acquisitions? Because that's not something that we see kind of on a rating scale, right? That's not going into exactly how a team's portal rankings are going to fall. Is this guy has leadership skills or whatnot? But do you see that in conversations as you're talking to players or even coaches about who they're targeting? How much of that, like, winning experience or leadership ability is playing into evaluating who we want to bring in?
Yeah, no, without a doubt, it's something that coaches bring up a lot. I mean, you know, not all double-figure scores are created equal. Some guys do it, you know. So a team's going to score 60-plus points in a game. Somebody's got to score the points. You might be 2-30 on the year. Somebody's got to score the points and whatnot. Those points aren't built the same as, we'll say, Alexis starting 20-whatever games for an NCAA tournament team, or Cam Heidi starting 25-whatever games it was for Texas. Or, you know, they're built differently. It's a cultural thing that you bring in to the locker room. So people that expect to win, they have won at every stage they've been in so far, and they expect that to happen. It's a standard that you're kind of setting without necessarily having to set the standard for yourself. You don't have to rebuild the mindset of somebody who comes in and expects to win 20-plus games. Now, will that happen? Yet to be determined. Tough league, all that type of stuff. We'll see what the rosters do. But the mindset coming in, it brings a cultural standard into the locker room. I think that, yes, it's a very real thing that coaches do talk about.
And if you, Rob and Jamie, I want to get y'all's take on this, but especially for Lamont Paris, bringing only two guys back, there is no culture. There is nothing established, which is why I think it's really big for South Carolina. The last transfer we're going to talk about, Jamie, before we get to the lone recruit in the recruiting class is, now I'm going to butcher this one. I believe it's Jacob Nakas. Man, Jamie, when I went into my deep dive on him, I didn't realize that he was like 6'7", just like 3.5 years ago. Didn't start playing basketball until he was 12. He's not your rigid brute of a big man. He has some fluidity to him that I didn't expect.
Yeah, so he's somebody, he's got international experience with his home country, and he's got actually a lot of success with that international experience. I mean, double-figure score, 8 to 9 rebounds a game coming with that as well. He's also somebody who comes in positional size, there's some fluidity that he brings there too, and can stretch the floor a little bit. He can pass the ball. He can process ball in hand a little bit, and he brings that length and size to the floor as well. Obviously, he never got quite caught up in at Duquesne into the consistency of playing time and minutes and everything, but there's a lot of value that he brings there as a role player, as a connector, especially as a big who can do it across multiple positions. Again, I keep coming back to it, ball in hand decision-making, stretching the floor and spacing. Kind of everybody fits into that role, and I think that Jacob is another player in that mix who can give minutes off the bench, or you can start him in bigger lineups or however it is that you want to use him to be able to bring that versatility, positional versatility, with some unique decision-making ball in hand and being able to stretch the floor. You have to stay attached to him because he can knock down a shot as well.
I think it's interesting, and look, it's such a cheap analogy here or comparison. But like with Mike Kotsar, like he got much better from freshman to senior year. And I watched some games of Duquesne, and there was one game where it was a fast break. They pitched it up to Jacob. He took two dribbles and dunked from half court. So, yeah. I mean, he's a guy that has long legs. He's still – the Gamecocks haven't seen anybody like that in a while. And Kotsar could probably do that towards the end of his career. And, you know, Jacob's coming in as a senior. The last kid we need to talk about just from the player folks is Marcus Johnson, Michi's little brother. He's a highly rated guy. Jamie, what do you think about him?
Yeah, so Marcus, he's actually Michi's cousin.
Cousin, yeah.
Yes. But yeah, no, Marcus, there's some similarities there to Michi. Not necessarily a point guard, smaller size. He doesn't have the pop that Michi has. Michi had some athleticism, especially 0-60 type of twitch that got him downhill. Marcus is much more smooth with the ball. So he's got the go-tos and counters off the bounce and the footwork that can get him clean looks pretty consistently. He's a score-first type of guard, but he's somebody who is placed with the utmost amount of confidence. Not quite as tall as Michi, not quite as the pop with Michi, but like I said, the craft, he might be a more consistent shooter than Michi was as well. But yeah, so there's some on-ball confidence that he brings. And when Lamont previously has put a lot of freedom with his guards and ability to kind of boogie a little bit, Marcus has that ability to consistently create clean looks off the bounce.
You think he has he can make an impact in year one?
Let me think of the roster. I think he's going to be given the opportunity to. I mean, unless they just bring some killers in the backcourt coming back, I think he's going to definitely get the opportunity to come in. As you well know, with freshmen, it all depends on how quickly they pick up the defensive side of the ball, especially with Lamont Paris, how quickly they pick up the defensive concepts and being able to guard, but also the offensive quick hitters and stuff as well. So speed of the game and how quickly the gaps close and everything. So he's going to be given the opportunity, I believe. I don't think necessarily start, but to be able to come in and give some minutes.
Jamie, here's the culminating question. When you look at those acquisitions, I guess we could say, and like Matt said, only a couple of guys coming back, is it enough to be competitive in the SEC? You talk about the depth and the strength of the league. This program has not been good the past couple of years, and I think that the next step is obviously to find a competitive spirit and an ability to be in more of these games moving forward. I think that it's a kind of a make or break year, obviously, for Lamont Paris, and we'll kind of call a spade a spade. It's a tournament or bust kind of situation, but you got to start with being competitive in your league. What's your evaluation of how this roster kind of fits with the other moving pieces across the league?
Well, there's multiple answers to this for me. The first one I'm going to give is two or three years ago, whenever the Talon Cooper year, when they were good, their pieces were not as good as anybody else in the league. When it comes down to man-to-man talent, they weren't as good as, but they won games. They had a roster of guys on the court who bought into the system, who believed in one another, and they made enough plays to be able to come out on top. There were a couple games in Lamont Paris's last year. They just got the doors blown off of them. However, if you look at it, a lot of the games, they were close. There was a lot of, like, they didn't win them, but they were close. Again, with not near as much talent as the other teams that they're on the floor with and all that. So to sit there and say, is this enough? I don't know. Because Lamont Paris's good year, it shouldn't have been enough, but it was absolutely enough. And I think that if you look across the lineup here, obviously they don't have a Talon Cooper, and I can't stress how important Talon Cooper was to winning. But if you look across man-to-man, there might be more talent on this team than there was on that team. Now, the SEC is not as good as it was 2 years ago when they put the record amount of teams in the NCAA tournament. Obviously, tons of draft picks. You have draft picks and Hall of Famers all over the league and everything too. But the SEC isn't as good as it was this past year. If they can kind of find a way to win these games where they're within 5 points, you know, with 2 minutes left to go in the game, if they can find a way to get it a run and win those games, the season could be completely different. Again, more talent on this team man-to-man than there was a couple of years ago with that. We'll see what it looks like again, because there's not much continuity coming from man-to-man. But I agree with you 100%. This is a make-or-break year. This year is huge for Lamont. And I think that you're seeing him do that. He made some moves when it comes to the coaching staff, made some moves when it comes to getting rid of guys and bringing in guys. So I think that there's an understanding there that this is a massive year. And, going forward, I think that you're seeing this school as well backing that up. Opening it up when it comes to NIL and all that type of stuff, giving Lamont the resources to be able to go out and go be competitive, to bring in players and acquire a roster that can be competitive and all that too. So I think that this is the year where there are no excuses, but also is very big when it comes to the future of Lamont Paris for this program.
Yeah, Jamie, because it's so interesting to me, because I think about it, the year you keep referencing with Talon Cooper, BJ Mack, and you had Michi Johnson all performing at high levels, you had pieces, right, that just made, and it wasn't 10 plus 10 equals 20, it was 8 plus 5 equals 20, whatever. Yeah. But But at the end of the day, Lamont Paris set a program record for wins. Yeah. So, yep. You know, that's
it, can be done. And like I said, when you look at this roster man to man, you see the vision. You see what he's looking for. You see the spacing, and you see what he's leaning into. You see the type of players that he's bringing in, the winning culture that he's building with the players to come in. And, you know, you see what it is that he's trying to build here. Now, will it be enough? The SEC's good, man. I mean, the SEC's good top to bottom, and it's good every year. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll definitely see. And, Jamie, man, we want to have you on again. I know that we told you 20 minutes, so we appreciate you. We'd love to have you on, talk some Gamecock hoops as we get closer to the season. We've had some questions roll in the chat box that we'll get to next time. But man, thank you so much for being on.
I got a couple minutes if y'all do. I can answer a couple things if y'all need.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Jamie, one of the questions that came in, and it says, you know, is high school recruiting situation completely different now with the portal? The question says, it seems to me that some 4-star and even 3-star kids will have to take a step back in college. And I mean, I can tell you what I know. I know that there's a lot of high programs that if you're not top 60 in the country, they probably rather have you develop somewhere else and bring you in 2 to 3 years. But, you know, for South Carolina, you really just – you can't just bank on portal every year. So what's your thoughts on South Carolina high school versus portal?
Yeah, no, 100%. So I think yes, the recruiting landscape has 100% changed over these past couple of years. You see these guys go in the portal. I think there's less of an unknown when it comes to recruiting the portal. You see this guy go up against Division I talent or whatever it is, college-level talent, and you've seen him start these games. These guys have been parts of Division I programs. They've gone through the rigors of school. They know what it takes to come in. And you as a coach, there's not a lot of guesswork in it. With high school kids, there's still guesswork, no matter how talented it is. There's still guesswork involved as to how they're going to react, the adjustment period and all that stuff as well. So I think when you look at a lot of it, you want, the transfer portal is massive. Also, coaches want continuity. When you get to year 2 and 3 of having a player on the floor, whether that's as a, you know, bringing them in as a freshman and having them sophomore, junior, senior year, or bringing them as a freshman, sophomore, junior year, continuity is what wins. And then patchworking through the transfer portal, I think, is what a lot of coaches really want. As one told me recently, a coach in the Big 12, that's the honeypot, is getting guys for year 2, 3, and 4. So, yes, the price point is going to be different, I believe, when it comes to, and I think that, you know, 3 years ago when you're bringing in a high-level high school kid, the price point of that kid is a whole lot different than it is now, because the expectation of playing time, you want to be able to invest in a kid, what you're going to be able to get back from him in return. So I think that aspect of it, but as long as everybody's kind of bought in as to what it is and a player being able to come in and earn minutes, in the school and develop within the program, I think the honeypot, as this coach called it, for having players for 2, 3, and 4 years is where most college coaches want to be.
Jamie, I'll follow up here. You mentioned the kind of the price point is different, and you mentioned earlier South Carolina putting more money into this team this year in terms of NIL dollars. But correct me if I'm wrong, everybody's doing that, right? So is it enough for South Carolina specifically, do they do enough NIL-wise, I guess, raising the water level of what was being invested? Because everybody else is investing too. It can be easy for programs, in my observations, to kind of get behind, and then you're playing catch-up, and you either have to have 1 year where you take a massive leap in dollars invested, or you're kind of just matching where teams were a year or two ago, trying to still climb your way back into it. And then it comes down to evaluations and kind of hitting and overachieving 1 year to get yourself back on track.
For sure. Yeah. So it was my understanding that this year they were in line with the SEC, not even the mid-tier SEC, lower-tier SEC. They were in line with the upper-tier SEC when it came to dollars and cents as to what they were able to provide. And they were involved with a lot of high-ticket items throughout the entire process. Now, obviously, being South Carolina, the record they had last year, the record they had the year before that, what the national perception is of you know, Lamont Paris's tenure moving forward as well. Other schools were able to win out a little bit on a couple of the guys. But when it came to the process of the NIL and all that, I was told South Carolina was in the mix, and some of the numbers I've been hearing as well puts them firmly in the mix with other top-level programs. Now, not the top, but the top-tier guys in the SEC.
Well, I mean, you think about Thomas Hawk at Florida. I mean, his NIL this year is going to be more than South Carolina spent on its entire roster last year. You know, Jamie,
last year it was abysmal. I mean, last year was amazing. They were able to get a win in the SEC with the amount of money they had to spend. My understanding, it was significantly bumped to this year.
Yeah, and that's where I was going to go. And I've talked to enough boosters throughout the course of this season, and they were honestly shocked, Jamie, when they heard what other teams were spending. And for folks that wonder why Lamont Paris is still the head coach at South Carolina, there were boosters that went to his back and just said, "We let you down. We didn't understand what you were working with." And, you know, some Gamecock fans can say, well, that was on Lamont Paris and Jeremiah Donati for not figuring that out, you know, coming off of an NCAA tournament 2 years ago. But it's so hard to capitalize in that market, I feel like, even though you came off a successful season. When I don't mind, like, the number was like between 5.5 and 6.2. It's what I heard last year that I'm pretty daggum certain about. And it's probably more than doubled this year. Now, is it going to be what Kentucky was, a number like last year, 25? I don't think so. Florida's probably 25, but I don't think many other SEC programs are above, you know, 12 to 15 just on average. And that's probably, you know, the higher end. But Jamie, would you agree with that?
Yeah. I think you're kind of spot on. The number that I heard for last year was a little bit lower, but in the same ballpark as well. The number I heard from this year, obviously double what you said as well. So, yeah. And I think, too, that we're kind of getting skewed a little bit as on the top end, because we're hearing the numbers of the top schools. Most schools aren't working with that, just like you said. You know, most schools are in the same range as to kind of where South Carolina is this year as well. You know, so a lot of that comes, though, with having the continuity of the roster, getting guys on, you know, back-to-back years and all that type of stuff as well. But having to go out and build an entirely new roster, it gets pricey.
It does. And, Jamie, we'll get you out of here on this one, but I know you're probably tracking this 5-for-5. Mm-hmm. That's going to impact college athletics. Where do you think this thing is? How fast does it get across the finish line? And is that good or bad for a team like South Carolina?
It depends on who's done with eligibility next year. I mean, it's kind of one of those things. Is, you know, it's going to affect. Let's see, it's going to affect the high school moving down. It's definitely going to affect JUCO and prep schools and everything. But you know, it's an attempt to even the playing field. We'll see how it does. People have usually been pretty good about finding loopholes when it comes to doing that. But it's an attempt to kind of even the playing field of, you know, once you hit 19, getting guys out by 24 years old with very few exceptions and all that. So, you know, we'll see kind of how it plays out and what it does. A lot of coaches I talk to are expecting it to happen next year. Obviously not this year right now. So the current seniors last year don't get it, but the next crop this next year does. That's the premise that most of the coaches are working on that I talk to.
Yeah, because I mean, golly, you know what they're doing at LSU right now is just—he's gonna test it, man.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of those guys don't have the eligibility. We'll see if they get it. And there's, you know, there's a couple more names that I've heard down the pipeline as well. So, you know, it'll be fascinating to see what Will Wade rolls out on the court game one.
Well, Jamie, for Rob and I, thank you so much for doing this. We'll make sure to get you back anytime you're available and you'd like to do it. But thank you. And, you know, just happy to have you, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Guys, I appreciate y'all. Thank y'all so much. I can't be more excited to have y'all on. South Carolina native and all that type of stuff, too. Super excited to see how y'all are able to build and keep going. So that's awesome, man. At any time, please don't hesitate.
Thanks,
Jamie. Thanks, Jamie. Well, Rob, I think that was quite insightful. And when you get a guy to the national level like that, I mean, it's just so fun to pick their brain and, you know, figure out where they think South Carolina is. It's interesting that, you know, Jamie is a South Carolina resident, so I'm sure he pays attention to the in-state schools. So that was great. I know we got to hit a quick sponsor break. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about Kendall Briles in year one at South Carolina. Welcome back into the Late Night Gamecock Show. Again, my name is Matt Anderson, and joining me is Rob Williams. You can find both of us at thebigspur.com, where we are talking Gamecock athletics 24/7, nonstop. It's so much fun. And what we're going to reference now is actually some articles that you can go on thebigspur.com and read. I've been poring over the Kendall Briles era post-Baylor. And the reason I did it post-Baylor, Rob, is I wanted to separate him from his dad. Right. I think that's important. I think that, you know, you saw former Steve Spurrier quarterbacks go try and do it, you know, as offensive coordinators. When they left Spurrier and they went somewhere else, they didn't do it quite as well. And not just former players either. So what I looked at, Rob, is I wanted to just look at Kendall Briles and what quarterbacks did the first year that he was their coach. So we got to go all the way back to Florida Atlantic. At Florida Atlantic, guess who hired him? Lane Kiffin. Then he went to Houston. Major Applegate hired him there. Excuse me. Then he went to Florida State. Willie Taggart hired him there. Then he went to Arkansas. Gosh, who was it? Arkansas then? Was it?
It was the Pitt boss.
It was Pittman. Yeah, it was Pittman. And then obviously Sonny Dykes over at TCU most recently. But I'm going to paint a picture here, Rob, and then you just tell me your initial thoughts. First-year quarterbacks in a Briles system, 65.2% completion percentage, 8.2 yards per pass attempt, 6.7% touchdown rate, which is just the number of touchdowns they throw divided by passes attempted, and a 2% interception rate. So then I'm going to tell you that Lenore Sellers for his career is 63.4% passing, 8.5 yards per pass attempt, 5.5 touchdown rate, and 2.5 interception rate. So what are your thoughts just looking at those numbers and knowing what Lenore Sellers has dealt with?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing for me is that Kendall Briles has found success pretty much everywhere that he's been with different types of players. So I don't think it's a situation where you have a system that doesn't match up with a player. You know what I mean? You know, we've seen that before. I do think that last season, when you look at Lenore Sellers, you get the argument, right, that he could have – what if he why did he regress, I guess, is the question. And I think it was the scheme, to be honest with you, Matt, because we saw him – I don't – if you look at defenses in front of him, I don't know that they did things a ton differently than they did the year prior in terms of like spying him or figuring out there's a team here or there that maybe did some things like that. But it looked like a fundamental shift in the way that he was approaching the game and the looseness with which he played as a redshirt freshman versus last year. So I think that it's a good match when you put him with Kendall Briles, especially when you look at those numbers, because I think that the Briles system can highlight its best players, and the best player on this offense is without a doubt still Lenore Sellers. And I think that Kendall Briles kind of is in a position to coach the good things out of him that he has. I don't want anybody to kind of lose faith based on what happened last year, because Kendall Briles is the type of coach that comes in and pulls the good out instead of kind of suppressing it and almost exposing weaknesses of his own player like we saw a little bit last year.
Yeah, there's some crazy stats that I pulled out of these articles, Rob, where, I mean, the passer completion percentage went up by like 8%. A lot of, like, when you look at the average, the touchdown rate went up by like 3 to 4%. The interception rate always stayed low. And I think people remember Lenore Sellers' interceptions because they were kind of backbreaking in a sense. So they're highlighted, but Lenore Sellers, he doesn't really throw interceptions, guys. He throws interceptions just like elite quarterbacks in the SEC do. The problem last year was when he threw them, it's when you had no margin for error. And it was, you've been fighting and clawing to stay in this game, and boom, interception. Oh, a fumble, a sack, something like that. So, you know, I'm excited for Lenore Sellers in this Briles offense because it's going to be getting the ball out quickly. You talked about scheme earlier, Rob. These seven-step dropbacks, they're in the playbook, but they're not every play. And that's the problem. A seven-step drop and, you know, three receivers 20-plus yards downfield with a shoddy offensive line, that's not Briles. But Lenore Sellers played it in high school, Rob, and you might remember this, a very, very run-heavy South Lawrence offense. Well, Kendall Briles would prefer to run the ball 60 to 63%. Maybe even 65% a game. And some of that will be Lenore Sellers. But those quick outs, those quick decisions, that's where Lenore thrives because it's not open. I don't have to think about my drop back. I just look not open. Where can I go? With the ball or with my legs?
Yep. I think what you said in one of your articles that really jumps off to me, and you just highlighted it there, is Kendall Briles' affinity for running the football. Because I think that marries perfectly with the personnel. Not to contradict myself from a minute ago when I said that Kendall Briles uses his personnel based on their strengths. But I think naturally what he wants to do and the players that are on this team kind of melt together in an amazing way. And here's why. Because he prefers to run the football and go fast, you have a player in Lenore Sellers who is a run game opener. He's a run game unlocker in the same way that Kendall Briles is from a scheme and a play calling standpoint. Because Lenore Sellers poses a phenomenal running threat when utilized correctly. I don't think that we need to see Lenore Sellers running a lot of power. We don't need to see him running a lot in between the tackles because he is an elusive kind of shifty type of player. If you can get one of those holes to break open, sure. But a lot of times when we've seen Lenore Sellers be at his best, he either beats somebody around the edge who loses contain because he's elusive. He's deceivingly fast, and he's faster than most defenders who are on the line of scrimmage that are going to try to get out there and contain him. Or it is what you described a minute ago, Matt, where he's going to go one read and then pull. When things break down, the Lenore Sellers magic happens when he has the freedom and ability to do so, and when the offense is set up to open those types of opportunities for him. So I think that when you have a guy like Kendall Briles who wants to run the ball, you set up a lot of opportunities to confuse defenses or put them in a position to choose who's the ball carrier. Is it Matt Fuller or is it Lenore Sellers in this situation? Is it Matt Fuller or Lenore Sellers or the man in motion at the snap? I think that you're going to be able to see a lot of opportunities like that really put Lenore Sellers in an advantageous position to just be a playmaker and go back to his roots, kind of what you described there at South Florence.
Yeah, and you know, I'm looking at this right now, and I just pulled it up because this is what I had in my mind when I was writing that article and thinking about how Lenore's can thrive. And you've kind of teed it up, but to give Gamecock fans just a recent memory, go back to the first drive of the season last year against Virginia Tech. It's a 7-play, 75-yard drive in 2:51. And if you go back to that drive, you know, there was a pass to Mo Brown. Then there was a Nick Harbor 20-yard completion. Then there was Lenore Sellers scramble. And then, you know, Lenore gets into the end zone. And it happened so fast. And it was like, wow, that's the future Heisman Trophy winner right there. How is anybody ever going to stop him? And that's what you have to get Lenore Sellers back to. You know, going back to last season, just how putrid it was. And I hate to go back on, you know, terrible times for Gamecock fans. But last season, the Gamecocks averaged 22.7 points per game, converted 31.8% of their third downs, only averaged 336 yards of offense, and gave up 43 sacks for negative 358 yards. If you look at Briles at TCU in Arkansas, he averaged 30 points a game. And you might say, oh, TCU, they don't play defense over there. Well, they play defense in the SEC, and he averaged 30 a game at Arkansas. You know, he converted 45% of his third downs at TCU, 38% of his third downs at Arkansas, averaged 438 yards of offense at TCU and 434 yards of offense in three seasons at Arkansas. And the big number here, and I think this is where Kendall Briles will help Lenore Sellers so much, Rob, is that TCU, despite a pass-centric attack, only gave up 19 sacks per season for an average of negative 130 yards. At Arkansas, despite having running quarterbacks and Felipe Franks and KJ Jefferson, gave up 31.6 sacks per season for negative 199 yards. You're talking about over 100 yards, in some cases 200 yards of offense coming back to your season. And, you know, normally they say that you should have 21 to 27 points for every, you know, 80 yards you get of total offense. So you just add that back, and it's two more touchdowns. What did two more touchdowns do last year in some of those games, Rob?
Exactly. And, you know, a couple of things here off of that, Matt. One is momentum is a real thing that we can't measure. We don't have a metric for it, but a sack is a big momentum play, and it's a drive killer in a lot of cases. And one score is also a big momentum play. We can't go back and rehash a lot of things, although we do from time to time. where a second quarter touchdown or even a field goal or even an extended drive changes the complexion of a game completely, but there was a sack that just killed it, negated everything, cut it off. You give the ball back to the other team and they quick score, and now you're down 14. The other thing that I would say is when you put this type of offense that's going to up your production in terms of points on the board, you go from 22 to even if you go 22 to 26, 28, somewhere in that range, with the defense that South Carolina can put onto the field, that might be enough, Matt. That might be enough to get you into that 8-9, dare I say 10-win range, challenging for a postseason spot in the college football playoff, because the defense, from what we know, it has been consistent over the past few years with Clayton White, and the personnel continues to impress. The personnel continues to either stand pat where it is or improve year over year. So I see a lot of opportunities when you put a Kendall Briles offense. If you just increase production a little bit with this defense, then the South Carolina football team, which is what everybody listening and watching here cares about, is going to be productive in terms of wins. That's it. What the formulas are different for everybody, and they're different from year to year. But when they add up to wins, we're not sitting back and breaking down having to do as many deep dives as what you're doing right now.
Yeah.
The deep dives that you're doing, picking through these numbers to figure out why things are going to change and how they're going to improve and what it does in this place or that place, is because there's not wins on the field to talk about.
Yeah, and to put a number on that, and you mentioned the defense, Rob, South Carolina over the last three seasons have only given up 22 points per game to their opponents.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, and you look at that. And
exactly. So if you get up to 25, 26 points a game offensively, we're having a completely different discussion.
Exactly. Well, we got to let Rob get out of here. Rob has an SEC Sunday night show that's about to start in 2 minutes. So everyone hop on over there. That's where I'm going after this. Rob's talking about Georgia tonight. Fired up for that conversation. Rob, man, appreciate you being on the show tonight. Loving it so far. We're going to keep it going. And any parting shots before we get out of here?
No, I will say I appreciate you. And this has been really fun tonight. Jamie Shaw was fantastic. You are fantastic as always. I appreciate your preparation and putting all this together. You guys make sure that you go read everything that Matt has over on thebigspur.com. You can get it for just a dollar until the season begins, or until the preseason begins. Tonight on SEC Sunday night, obviously Georgia's bats are freaking hot. It's crazy, just mowing through the competition. We've got a Texas A&M football preview coming up tonight, and we've got some friends coming in to have some fun with us. So it'll be entertaining, to say the least.
Well, we appreciate everyone that hung out with us here tonight. When you hang out with us, you give us the most valuable thing you have, and that's your time. So thank you. We will see you next week, and we can't wait for it. Hope everyone has a great Memorial Day tomorrow. And just remember, you know, why you're getting to celebrate that holiday. So for myself, for Rob, I wish you a good night and happy next week. Talk to you soon. Bye, everybody.